Well, hold your papers up high. Forget all your worries. Well, troubled poets can't die. They're the meat of the story.
Good morning and welcome to Voices in the Valley, where we celebrate the creative spirit and nurture the art of storytelling. My name is Steph, and today we continue our How to Write a Novel series, first aired the beginning of 2016. Voices in the Valley is taking the month of January to regroup and expand to include a YouTube channel and a podcast series on iTunes, as well as being aired each Saturday morning at 10 a.m. on KLBB 1220. While we prepare to relaunch onto multiple platforms, we are taking the opportunity to revisit some of our most engaging interviews with authors. Last week, we considered how to create a writer's routine and build conflict within stories. Today, we go back in time to February of 2016 as author Stephanie Lansom provides tips on how to research a historical setting, and David Arndt discusses how to write historical dialogue by referencing his book, The Grim Patriot. We hope you enjoy the show and perhaps even become inspired to start your own story. Let's begin with the interview with Stephanie Lansom.
Well, we're excited today because we are introducing two new hosts. We have Anna Claire and Aurora from Liberty Classical Academy. Welcome, ladies. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Mrs. Atkins. Today, we're here with Stephanie Lansom, and we're very happy that she's here. And she is a historical fiction author. And Stephanie, we were wondering if you could tell us maybe a little bit more about your work and what you like about it.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. Yes, I write historical fiction. I have three books out right now. They're Christian fiction, and they are biblically based. So when you're talking about setting, it's really fun to do a biblical setting, and it's a bit difficult, a little tricky, but it can be done.
Hi, Stephanie. Okay, so we were just wondering, what or who inspired you to write?
Well, I love to tell people about who inspired me to write. I have four children, and when my youngest daughter went into kindergarten, my oldest daughter, Rachel, we were driving in the car one day, and she said, "Mom, what do you want to do now that you have all this time on your hand, now that we're all, time on your hands, and we're all in school?" And I said, "I don't really know, because I'd spent the last 10 years at home with my kids." And she said, "What would you do if you could do anything?" And I thought for just a second, and I said, "I would write historical fiction." And she said, "Well, why aren't you doing that?" I said, "Well, because I don't know how. I've never done it before. I was a history major in college, but I've never written fiction." And she said, "Mom, you would never let us get by with that." Which is true. And she said, "You try it. Do it. You just give it a shot and see what you can do." And I said, "You know what? You're right." And that's what got me started. The next day, I decided to sit down and see what I could do.
That is so cool.
I know. So thank you, Rachel.
Yes, thank you, Rachel, for this wonderful author that we have sitting next to us today, who is a part of your creation. So the other question, along going hand in hand with that one, is what is your process of research that you began to find yourself stepping into a pattern of that you use to acquire the information from your books? As you said, you write biblical historical fiction, which right. is not always the easiest to write, and sometimes the information isn't very easy to acquire.
But you're right about that. And luckily, research is my favorite part. So I spend a lot of time with books. The internet is great when it comes to research, but there's nothing like your public library, because your librarian mm-hmm. can find resources for you that really are exactly what you need. So I spend a lot of time at the library. I check out lots of books and do a lot of reading, especially when for my biblical historical stuff, because you really need to know what you're talking about. So
cool.
Library is the first stop.
What would be one of your favorite sections there? Do you have a particular author that you like to study their work and research about?
Well, not particularly, no, but I guess the very best thing to use when you're doing biblical fiction is the Bible. It's got a lot of stuff in it that'll actually let you know, the historical details that you need to know. Really, there's just so much out there. It's more like sifting through and finding exactly what you need.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what would you say is the best resource for any writer that is interested in pursuing historical fiction?
The best resource for historical fiction is the library.
The library?
Yes. There are a lot of great websites when it comes to historical fiction, but it's really important to get the, you know, primary sources. If you've ever studied history, mm-hmm. There's primary sources and there's secondary sources. And you really want to get as much information from primary sources as you can. And also, it really helps with your plot and your story. Because even though you're making up things in your head as far as the plot, mm-hmm. You can get a lot of really interesting plots and dialogue right out of actual primary sources from history. So, library.
Nice.
Nice.
I love the library.
Who doesn't?
Each of your three books has a slightly different setting that of each, if you know the Bible, as some people do, have been based off of certain stories in the Bible that mm-hmm. you've expanded and written books off of. And they're all loosely connected to each other as kind of a three-part series, correct?
That's right.
So what I was wondering is, where did you have that moment where you went, aha, I want to write a book about this particular story?
Well, I've always been interested in the women in the Bible because we don't hear a lot about them. We kind of have to just guess what happens to a lot of them, and yet they're very important. And so I took some stories where women were really important in the Bible, and I thought to myself, what happened next for this woman? Like the woman at the well in Samaria. What happened next? And Mary and Martha, Jesus' friends, what happened to them after Lazarus was raised? So that's kind of where I have my aha moment, is finding a woman who is important and trying to figure out the rest of her story.
Okay. So you have three books. I'm just wondering, what's your favorite book out of all of those three? Do you have a preference?
I do. I would say the one in the middle. It's called The Thief, and it's about a kind of a outcast girl in Jerusalem who does what she needs to do to get by. And I won't tell you much more about her other than there's a bit of a twist in her story. And I love her, and so she is that's my favorite book, The
Thief. Personal
favorite character.
It's called
The Thief. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested already.
I've always loved biblical characters and finding out where their stories continue.
If you had to pick one major event in your life that you think influenced your writing, what would it be? Maybe a particular travel trip that you went on, or maybe even a near-death experience, things, or something just completely out of the blue?
I would say it's travel. I have traveled a lot. I started traveling when I was 17. And I think every country I've gone to has kind of opened up my eyes to different cultures and how people do things very differently. But really, we're all looking for the same things in life and mm-hmm. how we're very much the same, even though we seem to be very different. So I would say travel.
That is so interesting. And I have to say, I love to travel as well. And I'm so sad because we've come to the end of our time. There are so many more questions I have. I know I wish I could ask you, but let's do end with this. Could you please tell us your books and where we might be able to purchase them?
Oh, sure. There's three books. They're published by Simon & Schuster. So you can find them on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They're in some Barnes & Noble stores. They're in the Stillwater Valley Bookseller always has them, and usually signed copies at Valley. Or you can go to my website, which is stephanielansom.com.
Stephanie, thank you so much. And thank you, Aurora and Anna Claire, for doing such a nice interview with our author.
Yes, thank you for having us.
And so ended the interview with Stephanie Lansom. After a short break and a word from Nature's Notebook with Rebecca Coles, we'll return to the grim patriot author David Arndt in his discussion on dialogue. This is Steph. Up next, Voices in the Valley here on the Club 1220 AM. But first, joining us from the farm store in Stillwater, Minnesota, we have Nature's Notebook with Rebecca Coles. Good morning, Rebecca. What's up?
Well, we are going to talk snow today. I mean, have you ever really thought about how snow forms?
No, just that it's really beautiful to watch when it comes down, as long as you're cozy inside by the fire.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Well, so it's really, I'm telling you, if you want to do something with your kids or by yourself, you know, take a look at snowflakes. Typically, there are six actual types. They're classified in six different types. There's the lacy, you know, and there's the kind that come in different shapes. But there's also 35 that of those classifications that we can actually identify with our naked eye. So that's really cool, and I think that's really fun to take a look at. But a couple of things about snowflakes that I think are really fun. So snowflakes are not just frozen ice crystals. A lot of people think that's what it is. Uh-huh. That's not actually what they are. They do need ice crystals to form, however. So what happens, they're inside the cloud. There are frozen droplets of rain, if you will. So they become little tiny particles of ice. You absolutely need that for a snowflake to develop. And what happens, the water vapor, which is a gas inside the cloud, will start forming on that ice particle. Now, what happens is it stretches out to look like a hexagonal prism. And then, as it continues to be tumbled inside the cloud, that's when we start seeing these branches that stretch out and create that wonderfully beautiful, unique shape that we see. And of course, the more that it's stirred up inside the cloud, the more unique that snowflake becomes. And I know you can't say a degree of uniqueness, but they are different when we look at them. And when you look at what's going on outside, when you see snowflakes, if they're super teeny tiny, that means the air in that cloud was super, super cold. If, however, the temperatures when you're out are nice and around that 32-degree freezing point, that's when we get those beautiful, big, fluffy snowflakes that are the classic snowflakes that fall typically early in the season and later in the season when we're getting that warmer air around the area. So next time you're out and about and it starts to snow, pause for a moment. Take a look at these snowflakes. Get a magnifying glass. Get your kids out there. It's really fun when you start understanding how beautiful and different they all really are.
And I think there's nothing more magnificent, too, when you're out in a field and it's quiet. And the quiet of snow falling is just a beautiful thing to behold and to hear.
Yeah. And by the way, the largest snowflake in the world was 15 inches wide.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
You're kidding me.
It happened in Montana. It was larger. It was like the size of a pizza. And that happened, by the way, in 1887. We haven't seen it since, so maybe it wasn't that big, but it's in the Guinness World Book of Records. So
that's awesome. So we'll just have to believe it and not think it's the equivalent of the fish that got away story, right?
Exactly.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us for Nature's Notebook, and I know you'll be hanging out downtown in the farm store down in Stillwater, Minnesota, and so people stop on by and say hi if they're around on the weekends here in lovely
Absolutely.
Stillwater.
Hi, this is Emma Atkins, head writer for #HushPodcast and actress who plays the role of Andy. The Hush team is comprised of teenagers from all over the St. Croix Valley who write, perform, and produce an original sci-fi radio series. You may have heard our previous episodes played the first Saturday of every month here on Voices in the Valley. But now we are thrilled to announce Hush is on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. Please find us on iTunes and subscribe, rate, and review your own hometown, homegrown podcast. Our goal is to become new and noteworthy on iTunes, and you can help make that happen. Hush follows a teenage girl named Andy, whose parents and then grandmother mysteriously disappear. Andy and her friends set off to search for them on a quest that leads into multiple worlds filled with dangerous secrets and manipulative people, all kinds of fun characters. The voice of a strange being named Silence, a bumbling police officer who wants to train his pug to be a police dog, and well-intended but misguided adults aggravate the situation rather than making it better. It's been super fun to write and amazing to act in, and we want you to experience it too. So right after this episode of Voices in the Valley, check out iTunes, find Hush, subscribe, rate, and review. Also find us by Googling #HushPodcast. I hope you enjoy the show.
Life was simpler back in the day. The pace was slower, and the food more genuine somehow. It's still that way at Wayback Burgers. We use only fresh, authentic ingredients. Our delicious, juicy burgers are made to order and cooked to perfection. And our thick, creamy milkshakes are hand-dipped with real ice cream, the old-fashioned way. With Wayback's relaxing atmosphere and great food, things are as they were, only better. Taste freshness, America. Wayback Burgers.
Proud life across America. My dad says I'm his pride and joy.
My mommy says I was her big surprise.
My mom says I'm her best helper.
I'm adopted. My dad says I was a gift.
That's right, kids. Each of you are a miracle and a blessing from God. Hello, my name is Angie. I work with Pro-Life Across America, the billboard people. If you know someone who is pregnant and in need of confidential counseling, including alternatives to abortion or post-abortion assistance, please call Pro-Life Across America at 1-800-366-7773 or check us out online at prolifeacrossamerica.org. Pro-Life Across America is educational, non-political, and tax-deductible. Please help support our life-saving outreach.
A baby child is being 18 days from conception.
Pro-Life Across America, the billboard people.
We've been family-owned since 1922, and we still believe that it all starts with you.
Find your bonus tag at Stillwater Motors. Hurry in and save up to $11,000 on new 2017 Chevy 1500 Silverado Crew Cabs. Find new roads with your next vehicle from Stillwater Motors. Redunds family owned since 1922. Call 651-HEY-CHEV or go to stillwatermotors.com.
Stillwater Motors, good people to know.
Up next, author David Arndt on his book, The Grim Patriot, and how to write effective dialogue. If you are just joining us, you are listening to Voices in the Valley on KLBB 1220 AM. We like to celebrate the creative spirit and nurture the art of storytelling here at Voices in the Valley. And I am delighted that we once again have our hosts from Matamidai High School, 11th graders Jill and Rebecca. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having us again.
Yeah, we're happy to be here.
Well, we are delighted that you are joining us because we have a special guest again, and usually I let the student hosts introduce, but today I am going to exercise my power and my control by being the one to do it because I have a burning question I have to ask him. Will you forgive me?
Yes, we'll consider it.
Yeah. Okay, well, if you'd at least consider it, I'd appreciate that because we have sitting in between us David Arndt, who actually is, well, he's in a neighborhood that I used to live in, and I just have to ask you, David, as a past neighbor and of someone I'm so jealous of, because you have done something that I would love to do, which is you have completed a manuscript, and not only completed it, but had it published. And so here is my question for you. What did you do when there was that wonderful feeling of satisfaction when you had written the manuscript and sent it off to the publisher?
Well, I'm glad you asked. That night, we decided, in honor of the book, which is entitled Grim Patriot, we would go to Patriot's Tavern in Stillwater, which happens to be about a block from where I live. So the family and I went over to Patriot's and celebrated with a wonderful dinner there. It's one of our favorite little spots to go to, and we felt it was fitting given the genre of the book that I wrote and the name of the restaurant. In fact, I think I probably typed two or three chapters in that restaurant over the course of writing the book.
Ooh, can you point out the booth? Can we put a little placard that says David Arndt wrote here? Because that's where I'm going to write. I'm going to go to the Patriot now. It's the magic spot. It's not only cheers.
Let's see how we're doing in 12 months with book sales. And then we can discuss that corner booth and see if we can set up some sort of sponsorship.
Because I'm thinking writer's corner in Stillwater.
Yeah, of course, you'll have to pay me royalties on anything you write in that booth because it'll be my lucky booth.
Well, you know what? If I actually earned royalties, I'd probably be pretty glad to pay you for that. So I love Patriots. I know my husband and I used to always walk there, and you always know someone there, and the food is magnificent.
Yeah.
And here's a little tidbit that I just found out. I don't know if you knew this, but I learned that they have a menu that's friendly to celiacs. And so they have all of their pizzas can be ordered gluten-free, and then they have other items, salads and sandwiches and all that sort of thing that also are celiac-friendly. So the food can be delicious in a multitude of ways. So
I actually did know that because a good friend of mine is celiac, and we discussed it at one point. So
that's so cool.
He mentioned it to me,
Well, I love Patriots. And I am being reminded, actually, by the title of your book, Being the Grim Patriot, that that's what we're here to talk about.
That's right.
So thank you to
the Patriot for being a supporter of the Shire and Voices in the Valley and allowing me to wax eloquent about them. Well, actually, you did. Yeah. I'm just here to support you on that. So next time we'll have to talk at the Patriot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Anyway, all right, Rebecca and Jill, I am going to really close my mouth now and turn it over to you. So zipping it before Jenna plays the music on me.
All right. Well, hi, David. We're really happy to have you here.
I'm really honored to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Yeah. So besides what we have clearly established that your book is about patriots and being in the past America, what else can you tell listeners who may not be aware what your novel is about?
Sure. It's a historical novel set in Philadelphia in 1775. The main character is Joseph Grimm, thus the name Grimm Patriot. Joseph is a young man who is lost in his life, looking for purpose and something meaningful to do with his life. And he happens to stumble into a situation where he ends up joining an organization that was newly formed in November of 1775 was known then as the Continental Marines, which is now the United States Marine Corps. So he's there on day one when the Marine Corps is formed at Tun Tavern in Philadelphia. And the book follows his first couple of weeks with that organization. And so it mixes a little bit of history and a little bit of old time espionage, and it's a fun story. I hope people enjoy reading it.
Well, Jill and I both got to read an advanced copy of the novel, and we really enjoyed it. Could you tell us a little bit about the role that dialogue played in shaping that story? Because we noticed that there was a lot of excellent dialogue within its pages.
I really appreciate you saying that, because that's something that, as a writer, I'm proud of when somebody says that I write good, effective dialogue. Some of my favorite authors in the genre, historical fiction, are those authors who can really master dialogue. And it's a real trick with history, because as an author, you have to decide, do I try to stay true to the period of time that I'm writing about, or do I make the language more modern for the modern reader? Because there might be language and terminology that was used in 1775 that people just simply wouldn't understand. And it's a hard thing. You have to do a lot of research if you want to make really effective dialogue. There's two authors that I kind of drew on for inspiration in that regard. One is Larry McMurtry, who wrote the Lonesome Dove series of novels about the American West. And I don't think there's a finer writer of dialogue anywhere that I've ever read. I mean, it's amazing, rich, rich dialogue. And then Patrick O'Brien, who's my favorite author, and wrote the Master and Commander series. So if you saw the Russell Crowe movie, Master and Commander, that was one of those books. And he's another guy who wrote incredible dialogue, so much so that he had to publish a book called A Sea of Words, which is essentially a dictionary that you can use to look up the terminology that his characters speak, which is very authentic to early 19th century Great Britain. So those two really inspired me. So I spent a lot of time working on the dialogue to try to get it right, to get it so that it felt good.
Yeah, so, I mean, you totally touched on this, but if you want to go a little bit more in depth, what is it like trying to create dynamic characters while still trying to remain true to the time period?
Right.
The 1775-76 era.
Right. You have to decide how authentic do I want to try to be? And to be to really create authentic dialogue, you have to do a lot of research. You have to be looking at original documents from the era to get a feel for how people spoke back then. Mm-hmm. And this is my first book, so I tried to blend it. I tried to make it modern speech, but yet something that approximated some of those documents and letters that I've read over the years from the period of time. So it's a blend. I think to get it right, it would require a lot more research than I was able to do.
Right.
But that's something that, as a writer, I hope that I get better at each and every time. Yeah. You know.
That sort of leads into another question that Jill and I came up with here, which is that a lot of students find it difficult to reconcile real life conversation and story dialogue because they are very different often. Could you give us some advice about finding some sort of happy medium?
Oh. You know, write what you feel, mm-hmm. what you really feel the character wants should be saying in that moment. And then later, come back and look at it and tweak it and, you know, then worry about your word choice and your tone and things. It's important, I think, to create the character and say, what would the character be thinking and saying in this moment? But then there's always time to go back later and look at the language that you're using and what you're saying and what the character's not saying, which is sometimes just as important as what they might be saying, and tweak it and kind of work on the dialogue after the fact. Because if you get caught up, this is the lesson I learned, and it took me a long time to learn it. If you get caught up in editing and making a sentence perfect while you're writing it, you'll never get off the page. You'll be on the same, you'll be working that same page for a long time. So just write it down, let it set, and then come back to it later and work on it and make it more individual.
Okay, well, yeah, that's excellent advice. I'd never really thought about dialogue being created so much after the original first draft, you know, as part of going back and editing. That said, after you finish your first draft, what's the next step towards seeing it in print? What's the next part of that process?
Well, you know, you have to be willing to let somebody else look at it. I was really reluctant to do that because, again, it's my first book and I take a lot of pride in it. And I think I told you earlier, I'm both excited and terrified because, you know, I've put so much time and effort into it. But it's really important to get another set of eyes looking at that text and giving you constructive feedback. And don't be afraid of that. Don't be so emotionally involved in what you're trying to create that you won't let anybody see it, because there are things that I looked at on the page 100 times and it looked good to me. Mm-hmm. But that was just because I'd seen it 100 times. And I had somebody else look at it and they said, you know, this is kind of confusing. Can we talk about this? And that was actually happened to me, my wife, who did a wonderful job helping me edit the book. Don't get caught up in the editing first, and make sure you get somebody who can provide you with some good, sound, constructive feedback, and don't be afraid to show it to them.
That's great advice. I always worry when I'm doing my own writing, you know, about what other people are going to think about it. That's one of the biggest things that keeps it in my notebook.
To my eyes only.
Yeah, exactly. So we love the Valley Bookseller here in Stillwater.
Mm-hmm. And could you tell us a little bit about the importance of independent booksellers in the publishing industry now that you're a part of it?
Yeah, well, I love small bookstores. Other than probably a couple of chapters that I wrote at Patriots, and I'm not trying to be too obvious about it, but I spent a lot of time at the coffee shop that's in Valley Bookstore writing this book. They don't
because
know it, but
it's incredible.
It is. I was just there. I had a cup of coffee about half an hour ago. But I spent a lot of time at the coffee shop. I love small bookstores. I love to be able to go in and touch and feel a book. I love the smell. I'm not much of an e-reader myself. I've got to have the book in my hand. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, those small booksellers are such an important part of communities like Stillwater, where we are, because it's a gathering place, and it's a place you can sit and relax and really have the whole experience of reading, as opposed to you know, something where you're just downloading it. And nothing wrong with downloads. Please download my book, but I like to have the copy.
Yeah. You know? Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And that's something that we're so fortunate here in Stillwater to have such a lovely bookstore. So I have to just ask you, speaking of bookstores, so the Grim Patriot is currently at the publisher.
Yes.
And you're getting the cover art done and completing all those final pieces that must happen before it gets into the bookstores.
Right.
About when do you think it'll be available for us to buy?
I'm really hoping that it comes out here in the next month or so, in March. But in dealing with the publisher, you know, they have a process, and it's very careful and thought out, and they're going through helping me identify the cover art. And I'll get a chance to look at those proofs in the next week or so here to see what the book actually looks like. And then at that point, once we've resolved that issue, we'll be ready to go.
So hopefully
in the next, 30 days or so here into March, we'll be able to have the book on the shelf.
Awesome. Thank you, David.
Thanks for joining us here on Voices in the Valley as we meandered back in time to our How to Write a Novel series. We hope you'll join us next week when we revisit interviews with author Anne Greenwood Brown on the revision process and international bestselling author Brian Freeman on working with an editor. Now go and write.